And that slightly muffled version of our theme is because Giuseppe and the band are all wearing face masks. Welcome to the Little Wireless Program. Some time ago, in what was a captain's call, I guess, Tony Abbott decided we should plant 20 million trees, and I remember being quite exhilarated at the time. I thought, he's got that right. Well, it ain't necessarily so, and a little later in the program, we're going to have a discussion on the politics of trees with David Lindemeyer and Patrick O'Connor, two very well credentialed academics on matters of trees, and it may surprise you. Now, I'm pleased to welcome to the program a bloke I've long admired, of considerable integrity and determination. I don't know whether I've told him, but he's actually the winner of a koala stamp with oak leaf clusters, and they're very, very rare. He's currently facing trial for conspiracy to breach the Intelligence Services Act. In 2013, Bernard Cotteroy, a lawyer and barrister and former Attorney General of the ACT, and I'd forgotten that, had his offices raided when he was in The Hague. He was about to represent East Timor in a case against the Australian government in relation to, yes, the bugging of the East Timorese government officers during negotiations over Timor Sea oil. The witness to the bugging, known as Witness K, was also raided by ASIO, and he had his passport confiscated. Under Australian law, Bernard is not allowed to talk or write about the case, so he went to Cambridge, where he was given an office and started writing a book about the history of Australia and East Timor. Let me grab it so I can hold it up to the cameras because we're being filmed. And in particular, the way Australia has put the pursuit of oil against the rights of East Timor to find political and financial autonomy. The book Oil Under Troubled Water, Australia's East Timor Intrigue, is published by Melbourne University Press. Welcome to Late Night Live, Bernard.
Thank you, Philip. It's an honour to get onto your program.
Are you still alive and kicking?
I am indeed. I'm driving up and down the highway to Sydney because I'm only allowed to speak to my lawyers in Sydney from Canberra, only in the designated room at their office that's been cleared by the security services. So I have ample time to listen to your program and others on my car radio.
How did you first get interested in East Timor? Because you've been working there for, well, more than 30 years.
When I was 21, 22, and finishing law school here at Sydney University, I met, during some training I was receiving in one of the Australian intelligence agencies, a former Z Force commando who... Of course, this is not long after the Second World War, 20 years or so after. He told us about the East Timorese and how the population moved to support the encircled troops. I'd never forgotten that. And by 75, during the Whitlam years, I was away serving in Europe in another role, and I saw and heard and read some of the betrayal. So when I came back to Australia and left the service, I offered my services to the Timorese.
The voice of Bernard Collieri, and we're discussing his new book, Oil Under Troubled Water. You were given space in Cambridge to work on the project, but I understand the UK archives might have been a tad more accessible than Australia's.
Well, it was just so extraordinary. I then developed the habit of going to the National Australian Archives, listing their redactions, then I'd go to the Royal Archives at Kew, search the correlating files, and I'd find a lot of the redacted material at Kew. So I spent most of my time at Kew because, as I say in the book, the Australian Archives Act 1983 is not properly administered.
I understand that you've had to give up or effectively abandon your law practice.
Well, I shouldn't, given the community support on this issue. I shouldn't be doing jury trial work. Not that my clients accused would not get a fair trial, but they might well be, the juries might be disposed to vote for me rather than the accused. And so I've told the Chief Justice that I won't practice. But the Bar Council and the Law Society have both said, I'm free to practice, but my area of practice has been ruined because I've been a trial lawyer over the years.
But also I would imagine that potential clients might be a bit concerned knowing that ASIO had been bugging you.
Well, they've ruined my practice in Canberra, a public service town, and I suppose I should have expected that. Public servants are reluctant to come and unburden themselves in premises that were bugged. But I should say one thing, Philip. The Director General of ASIO, Duncan Lewis, did, in contradiction of the assertions being made elsewhere, clear Witness K to have a passport as not being a threat to national security. That's a significant issue that needs to be dealt with in court at some stage.
I want to talk to you about earlier history of East Timor. You've talked about your father's view, which is, of course, is loudly echoed across this country. But you say in the book that you believe it would have been better had Australia taken possession of East Timor after the Second World War instead of returning it to Portugal. Why?
Yes, when I read through Anthony Eden's private papers and the secret War Cabinet release documents at Kew, I found this fascinating super secret that was not shown to our External Affairs Minister or John Curtin, decision not to give Portuguese Timor to Australia after the war. Evatt, on behalf of Australia, had asked for Portuguese Timor to be given to us. He made that request in 1943, but because the United States and Britain wanted Portugal's assistance with the islands in the Atlantic, in the battle of the Atlantic against Nazi submarines, they wanted to keep Portugal on side. So we didn't get it. But once again, Philip, years later, during Prime Minister Menzies' era, the Prime Minister of Portugal asked rhetorically of Menzies in correspondence, which we secured, if we would like to take over the administration of Portuguese Timor to bring it, presumably, to self-determination, as we were doing in Papua New Guinea. Our External Affairs Department rejected it, and later documents reveal why. It wasn't to do with any empathy for self-determination to our north. It was all about oil and gas.
You're also particularly critical of Garfield Barwick, aren't we? Aren't you? Who was it in the 60s? He was the External Affairs Minister.
Well, the documents brought me round to that. I mean, as a lawyer, I read and studied this eminent lawyer's work. He was a commercial silk in Sydney, as you know, Philip, and held the two portfolios, so unusually, unprecedentedly, of Attorney General and Foreign Minister. But Barwick, when he was asked by Averell Harriman in 62, who he was the Undersecretary of State at Washington, if we would assist in bringing East Timor to independence, United States and North Britain wanted to be the leaders of that because they wanted to stay on side with Portugal for Cold War reasons. Barwick rejected that. And he rejected it, as we now know from the documents, because in his other portfolio of Attorney General, he was chairing the Committee of Attorneys General about oil and gas exploration in the Timor Sea.
I had a few rows, memorable rows, with EGW over the years. And if you really wanted to press the button that got Whitlam going, you mentioned East Timor. Why do you think he supported the integration of East Timor with Indonesia?
My conclusion from the documents, and not from year-later memoirs of the speechwriter and that, is from the documents itself, Gough Whitlam had the imperialistic view that as he had flown over those islands during the war as a navigator in an Air Force plane, Timor belonged with the group of Indonesian islands. It was an imperialistic view of his, and that's supported by Nancy Viviani, his advisor of the time. He just made that decision. The conspiracy theories about him following and having the smell of petroleum in his nostrils doesn't seem right to me, to do him justice on that front. But he remained very sensitive, Philip. You're right. I remember lining up to see meet Mary Robinson when the President of Ireland visited Australia, and by chance I was next to Gough and an eminent Australian jurist. I won't drag him into this, said Gough, it's time you shook hands with Kaleri. He wouldn't shake my hand. I mean, he was so sensitive about criticism over East Timor. I think if he had a clear conscience, he mightn't have been so sensitive, perhaps.
We've mentioned that the UK archives are more fruitful than the Australian ones, and I'm fascinated that you found something new on the Balibo killings.
Well, I didn't expect that, and I was saddened. I'd looked after for Shirley Shackleton.
She's a dear friend of mine, yes. as was her husband.
Yes. And so I helped with Greg's estate, and Shirley's written that such poignant poem about taking her husband's suits out of the cupboard and smelling his warmth and so forth. Shirley's still a grieving widow, and I speak to her or communicate with her every other day, Philip, and I think you understand what I mean. Given my closeness to that subject, and we are as lawyers often affecting our emotions, we have to, because it's a bit hard. You've got to stay steely or you'll cry sometimes. But I just got up from the table in queue and went through the strict security procedures, went out and had a cup of tea. I read a document from the British ambassador in Jakarta of the time that said the Australians learnt this morning, this is how immediate it was, that President Suharto had told his head of Secret Service that there was to be no exposure of Indonesia's then clandestine activities in Timor. And in the context of the British ambassador's record of that conversation with the Australians, referring, of course, to the Australian embassy in Jakarta, that a plane load of journalists and politicians, who, mind you, are very, very lucky, as it now turns out, were a hurdle to be overcome. In context and knowing the politics of Suharto and his ruthless suppression of journalism in Indonesia and in West Papua, a hurdle to be overcome left no illusion in my mind to whoever the Australians were who learnt that morning and told the British ambassador secretly, so secretly, was that the British ambassador said to the Foreign Office in Whitehall, the news should not be repeated to other Australian missions.
Most of our listeners are familiar with the story of East Timor. We did our best to tell it. We took the program there for a very memorable and, I've got to say, heart-wrenching time. 25 years, the Indonesians rule the place, sometimes with extreme violence. They depart from the country in 1999 with even more extreme violence. But in the background, there's the Australian government keeping an eye on what might happen to the border agreements. And we bring it forward to those fateful negotiations when Australia bugged the officers to gain an advantage in those negotiations. I hate to be cynical, but in the world of international espionage, wasn't bugging like this going on all the time?
Well, not between fiduciaries, and I'm only assuming from your question that there was some bugging. Of course, I can't comment on that, but taking your question as a
hypothetical,
we'll talk about misconduct. We were joint venture partners with Timor in the oil and gas exploration. As joint venture partners, we had what lawyers call a fiduciary duty. So that's different. If we're going to bug, for example, a Japanese whaling delegation on whale control, we're not dealing with fiduciaries. We're not a commercial partner. That's one difference that lawyers would see. But the other difference, of course, I've written about in the law journals, it's about treaty making in good faith. And we have, until, you know, the last 20-odd years, held ourselves up as exemplary exemplars in our region. And now, of course, we've lost totally our moral standing in our region.
The history of the maritime border is complicated, but a line was drawn, which was agreed to by the Portuguese, the Indonesians, and finally the East Timorese. Were we always upfront about what we knew lay beneath the sea?
Well, that's just it, and that's the thing in my book. I couldn't tell you, Philip, in this devastated country after Chanana Gusmao was released from detention in Jakarta, what it was like to see the ruins, the mass graves, the thongs and sandals floating in on every tide, leaving a tide mark on the beach. I couldn't tell you what it was like to be an Australian and to think we could have stopped this. I cover that issue in my book. But more to the point, how wretchedly poor this country was and what
is,
we had to do.
Is. Still.
Yes. So the real the problem for us is, you know, it's not just in sport that we'll underarm bowl. This shows a peculiar mentality, and I don't, you know, I think I say somewhere, in 30, 40 years of being a trial lawyer, and I've represented some less than savoury people at times, we'll just put it that way, and I've been tapped on the shoulder in cafes and that and said, how could you do it? Even been queried at home at times. In 35, 40 years, I've never once been stopped in the street about advocating justice for the Timorese. So where do the people involved in this underarm bowling, that's all I can call it legally, where do they get their authority from? Who said they could do this? And why did they keep the helium a secret?
Okay, you've now said the H word, helium. And that, to me, is the absolute blockbuster revelation of the book. Tell us about the helium.
Well, after the government that Australia and the UN put into power in 2002, after it departed in ruin and misery in 2006-07, I went back to Timor. I physically searched through the foreign ministry for documents and papers, and gradually we found what had been going on between Australia and the government the UN and Australia had put into power for the interregnum, as we call it. And when Chanana Gusmao was the first popularly elected leader of Timor, we found in the documentation, and we found because there was a helium plant being planned and could not be hidden from us, that helium somehow came into it. Then the research was done. We found that helium was worth almost as much as the gas. And then we found that of all the gas taken, almost the same value of helium had been taken. Then we found that Australia had connived to take the definition of petroleum out of all of the treaty documents and production service contracts to delete two words, and inerts. Helium's an inert gas, Philip, as you know. It floats balloons, but it also feeds nuclear reactors and a whole bevy of things. Our MRI examinations wouldn't be possible without helium.
So it's terribly important to medicine.
It's immensely valuable, and no explorationist looks at a liquid gas analysis without seeing how much helium's in it.
So there it was, under the granite dome in the Timor Seas, and it was all hushed up.
It was hushed up. Timorese hadn't, of course, trying to fight for survival and feed their starving population. You can't expect them to have researched helium. And more to the point, John Howard shook hands with the Timorese leader explicitly over a document in front of the world media, I saw it, promising to act in good faith to lift the Timorese out of their poverty. He shook hands and promised explicitly to act in good faith, provided the oil and gas industry experts chose ConocoPhillips and Woodside as partners, and all through that...
So Conoco and Woodside get the deal.
Get the helium. They get the helium. That's just it. It didn't come to us. We couldn't even act as a thief for our own benefit. We effectively became pickpockets into an empty pocket. We gave the helium away to ConocoPhillips, Woodside, in the future off Sunrise High, and to the contractor parties.
I understand that helium's being shipped to Japan and China for their nuclear industry.
Well, of course. I mean, it's such an important commodity. You know, meanwhile, Conoco was negotiating with, guess who, the Russians, Gazprom, their gas company, to build a similar plant to the one at Darwin, the 15th in the world, on the Siberian border between China and Russia. So helium is a number one issue for these nuclear powers, and we were going to supply it.
I'm talking to Bernard Collaery about his book, Oil Under Troubled Water, and as you've just learned, it's not just oil. LNL on RN. Now, could the helium secret be one of the reasons they're trying, one of the things they're trying to hide in the prosecution of Witness K?
Well, two things have to be said, Philip. I can't ask you a question. I've received a national security order under our terrorism laws that stops me talking, and I'm not allowed to talk in my own defence. I can't answer that question. I want an open trial in court under legal privilege so I can give you an answer, Philip.
Do you think the helium, can you answer this, should the helium deal be investigated by the National Audit Office when they're finished with other government rorts they're investigating?
Of course it should be. We've lost billions and billions. It's being estimated between 12 and 22 billion because the production figures are shrouded in mystery. Australia and Timor have so far lost between 12 and 22 billion dollars.
Well, we can perhaps afford it, but the Timorese can't.
No. I mean, it's just awful what we've done here. And of course they didn't read the fine print in the production service contracts. They were relying on a joint venture partner and the assertions by our Prime Minister that we'd act in good faith.
So when was the helium plant opened in Darwin?
It was opened in 2009 by Martin Ferguson.
Run that past me again.
Well,
the ex-boss of the ACTU.
Martin Ferguson did two things that year. He went up to Timor and pleaded with the Timorese government not to go ahead with its arbitration in The Hague. And I can't tell you what that arbitration is because I'm forbidden to talk about it. And then a few weeks later, he resigned. And a little time before that resignation, he opened the helium plant, which is across the way from the gas plant, the inert gases, which were called ironic. Waste gas in one of the agreements. Waste gas went under the road by a pipe to the helium plant, and he opened it and then resigned from the parliament. Weeks, months later, he joins the petroleum industry as a consultant.
In parenthesis, do you have a view on a federal ICAC?
Philip, your listeners can answer that for me. Of course, we want one.
I understand that you're heading into court again in April to argue for an open court.
Yes, and I'm to be tried by a jury. I'm entitled under Section 80 of our Constitution to a jury trial, and I don't believe it's a jury trial if it's a secret or semi-secret trial. Can't be a jury trial if the jury can't hear some of the evidence. I should know the evidence against me. My lawyers should know it. Public should know it, and I just can't believe that we allowed that law to pass after 9/11, brought in, I might say, ironically, by my law school classmate Philip Ruddock as Attorney General, where we said that if we were going to put terrorists to their trial, we wouldn't allow them to proselytise from court, we wouldn't allow them to identify our anti-terrorist workers, our Secret Service people, and we wouldn't allow them to find out our techniques. Who would have thought they'd use that law against me and Witness K? There's some great irony, sickening irony in that, which again, I can't speak of, but to use an anti-terrorist law against Witness K and myself will ultimately be relieved.
Can you explain to me why Witness K is going to plead guilty?
He's intimated a plea of guilty. This is a person who's been 7, 8, 9 years now in seclusion, under threat, no passport, wishing to enjoy children and grandchildren, terrified that his identity might be revealed, because by revealing his identity, there'll be foreign powers, nasty foreign elements, that might deduce that he didn't spend his entire career doing benign things. And so there's a complete power over Witness K. I'm going to speak to power. I'm going to speak truth to power. But a person whose children and grandchildren could be under huge threat if an identity is leaked is under immense pressure. And only those who've read Solzhenitsyn and know how the Soviet regime worked would understand where that man is at this time.
Okay, final question. Do you think a court will, given the facts of the matter, accept that a guilty plea from Witness K?
Well, I've had cases where a judge has said, on these facts, I'm not going to accept this plea. And I've had clients, as had many of my colleagues, who've said, I want to plead guilty to protect my family from shame or to protect a relative. And I've said, well, I won't. I can't ethically go to court and advance your guilty plea. So Witness K's lawyers have that bridge to cross, and as does Witness K's trial judge.
I've been talking to Bernard Collaery, lawyer, barrister, human rights defender, and all-round naughty person, now author of his important book, Oil Under Troubled Water, Australia's Timor Sea Intrigue, published by Melbourne University Press. Good on you, Bernard. And break a leg, as they say in the theatre. Coming up, the politics of trees.